The following is a lecture entitled Entering the Krishna Consciousness Dimension, given by His Grace Sriman Sankarshan Dasadhikari, recorded on April 2nd, 2008, in Heidelberg, Germany.
So, tonight, we are going to enter into an amazing dimension. Tonight we are going to enter into the dimension known as Krishna consciousness. Actually, the whole world is looking for this. They are trying to find it in varying ways, you see. They're trying to find the nectar, they're trying to find the bliss. But the bliss they always miss, because their method is a myth. They're going about it the wrong way, you see. Instead of putting the food in the mouth, they're trying to put the food in the anus. It doesn't work. You want to eat, you put your food in your mouth, you don't put it in your anus. I mean, what kind of asinine thing is that, to put your food in your anus, you see? That's what they're doing. It's an anus-feeding civilization. They're going about it the wrong way. That's where it comes out at the end, the waste products, you see. So they're completely reversing the whole process of how to be happy. Instead of putting God in the center, they put themselves. One might go, why would you put God in the center? What has He done for me lately anyway, you see? What has God done for me lately? What has God not done for you, rascal? He's given you the air that you breathe. He's given you the water, the food, the clothing, the shelter, the company, your intelligence, your body. He's given you your house, your dog, your car, everything. He's given you everything. Can't you at least thank Him every now and then?
Every day.
Is it? But you want to deny His existence. Oh, there is no God. What sort of gratitude is that? You think you can be happy denying that person who is your every well-wisher? You can be happy denying him? Of course not. If you cause pain to a beloved person who has done nothing but serve you through your whole life, can you be happy? No, it's not possible. You have to reciprocate the love that is given to you. You have to love that person back. And as soon as you do, you become happy. We are meant to exchange love. Even a plant has that tendency. Did you know that? You can make an experiment. In fact, it's been done in the elementary school. The teacher had the children do this experiment. You get two plants. And the same plants, same type of plant, the same type of soil, the same type of fertilizer, the same amount of water, the same amount of sunshine, everything the same, except one thing is different. But the one plant, you go, you rascal, I hope you just die. Here's your water. You see? And the other plant, you say, oh, my dear plant, you're so sweet and wonderful. I hope you thrive and become a wonderful, beautiful plant. And there's a difference. That plant that is given, dealt with in a tender, loving way, he thrives. And the one who's treated like he should be dead, does dry up. You see, does dwindle. So, if you want to really be happy, you have to be a loving person. And the purer you make your love, the happier you become. If you're a little bit loving, you're a little bit happy. If you become even more loving, you're even more happy. You see? If you can expand your love to the infinite level, to where it includes every single living entity throughout the totality of existence, then your love becomes unlimited, you see. And how do you do that? We've many times heard this example. When you water the root of the tree, what happens? All the leaves and branches they get water. So if you will give your love to the root of it, the existence, the root of creation, if you give your love there, then your love becomes, then it becomes known as universal love. You see? And then because you're loving universally, the happiness, the peace and happiness you experience at every minute will also be universal. So I think anybody who doesn't want to do this, they're really cheating themselves. They really are. They're cheating themselves. Because this is the technique how to unlock the unlimited happiness that is there within your heart. For millions of lifetimes, you have had this tendency to love. And it was never properly satisfied. It was never. You loved a boy, you loved a girl, and they ran off with someone else. You see? You loved your parents, but then they abused you. Some parents beat their children, you know. You loved your dog, and then he got hit by a car. You see? And he was finished. So in so many ways, you tried to give your love, but you were not satisfied. You were never fully satisfied. That's because you were not giving your love to the Supreme Person, the source of all existence, the place where you were always meant to give your love anyway. People say, I don't want to give my love to God because then I'll be neglecting my girlfriend, my boyfriend, my parents. I want to give my love to them. But that's an illusion. It's really an illusion. Because your love will always remain imperfect unless you give it to God. In modern day environmentalism, we have a popular word now, and everyone talks about it, recycling. You see? If you don't recycle, then it pollutes the earth, isn't it? That's what we always hear. You got to recycle, otherwise you're polluting. You're either a recycler or you're a polluter. Which one will you be, a recycler or a polluter? But they did not know what is actual recycling. Recycling means where it's come from, you put it back. You see? So, where is the energy ultimately coming from? Aham sarvasya prabhava mataksaram pravartate. Krishna says, I am the ultimate source of all the energy. So, if you don't recycle the energy that Krishna has given you back to Him, you are polluting the atmosphere of this universe. You see, you are a polluter. Anyone who is not a devotee, he is polluting the atmosphere on this planet at every minute because he is not recycling the energy back to Krishna. So tonight we want to study something about this in the Bhagavad Gita. How to understand things in such a way that we can, in fact, recycle all of our mental, vocal, intellectual, and physical energy totally, 100%, back to the supreme source of all energy, the Samam Bhanam, Krishna, Keshava. That we will study tonight. This is Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, text number 7. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Mata Parataram Na. It's Na Anyat Kinchit Asti Dhananjaya Mai sarvam idam protam sutre manigana eva. You may wonder why I said na when you didn't see it on the board. You ever wonder then? Why I said na instead of nan yat? In Sanskrit, that's how it works. It is called sandhi. You take the word na and you combine it with the word anyat, you see. And there are certain rules of combination for the sake of beautiful, poetic sound vibration. The words flow into each other, you see, very beautifully. So na, anyat, becomes nanyat. You see, there's na, which is a short, there's a short A is a, and a long A is a. So na is a short A, and anyat is a short A. Na, anyat. The two short A's combined together is one long A, nanyat. So nanyat is a sandhiized way of saying na, anyat, which makes the Sanskrit flow like a beautiful river, you see. So that's why I'm the word for word, there's something different than what you're seeing on the board. That's why you have to hear carefully what I'm saying so you can actually learn a little Sanskrit. That na, that nanyat is actually na anyat. So anyway, we'll continue now. Mata parataram nanyat kinchid asti dhananjaya mayi sarvam idam protam sutrai mani ganaiva matak parataram nanyat kinchid asti dhananjaya mayi sarvam idam protam sutre mani ganaiva. Beyond me, parataram, superior, no, not. And yet kinchit, anything else, asti, there is, dhananjaya, O conqueror of wealth, mayi, in me, sarvam, all that be, idam, which we see, Purotam is strong. Sutre on a thread. Manigana pearls. Eva like. Translation in purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. O conqueror of wealth, there is no truth superior to me. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. There is a common controversy over whether the Supreme Absolute Truth is personal or impersonal. As far as Bhagavad Gita is concerned, the Absolute Truth is the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna. And this is confirmed in every step, in this verse in particular. It is stressed that the Absolute Truth is a person. That the personality of Godhead is the Supreme Absolute Truth is also the affirmation of the Brahma Samhita. Ishvaraha Paramaha Krishnaha Satchirananda Vigraha. That is, the Supreme Absolute Truth, personality of Godhead, is Lord Krishna, who is the primeval Lord, the reservoir of all knowledge. These authorities leave no doubt that the Absolute Truth is the Supreme Person, the cause of all causes. The impersonalist, however, argues on the strength of the Vedic version, given in the Shvetvashvatara Upanishad 3.10, Tato yad utara tarang tad rupam anamayam yare tad vidur amritaste bhavati ate tare dukam evapayanti. In the material world, the primeval living entity within the universe is understood to be the supreme amongst the demigods, human beings, and lower animals. But beyond Brahma, there is the transcendence who has no material form and is free from all material contaminations. Anyone who can know him also becomes transcendental, but those who do not know him suffer the miseries of the material world. The impersonalist puts more stress on the word arupam. See, rupam means form, means none. It negates it. Arupam means no form, literally. So the impersonalist likes to stress this form, this word, I mean to say, the arupam word. But avrupam, even though literally it means no form, in the context you have to understand it means no material form. The Isha Upanishad, we'll read the purport, finish the purport, and then continue on these points. This avrupam is not impersonal. It indicates the transcendental form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss as described in the Brahma Samhita quoted above. Other verses in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad 3.8.9 substantiate this as follows, and I can point out that's the two verses which precede the one we just quoted. The Arupam verse is the 10th verse of the 3rd chapter. Now Prabhupada is quoting the 8th and 9th verses. So that means you have to understand the 10th verse in the context of the two verses which came just prior to it, the 8th and 9th verses. Let's see what they say about whether the Lord is formless or has a form. Vedaham itang purusham mahantam adityavarnam tamasa prarasthat tam eva vidyan ati mrityum eti nanya panta vidyate yanaya yasmat parang naparam ashtikinchid yasman naniyo najvayo stikinchit Vriksha iva stabdo divi tishtanye kas tanedam purnam purushena sarvam. I know that Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is transcendental to all material conceptions of darkness, only he who knows him can transcend the bonds of birth and death. There is no way for liberation other than this knowledge of that Supreme Person. There is no truth superior to that Supreme Person, because he is the supermost. He is smaller than the smallest, and he is greater than the greatest. He is situated as a silent tree, and he illumines the transcendental sky, and as a tree spreads its roots, he spreads his extensive energies. From these verses, one concludes that the Supreme Absolute Truth is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is all-pervading by his multi-energies, both material and spiritual.
Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Jata Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavamsha Shri Rupam Sagra Jatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadaitam Savadutam Purijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha. So, so this is to be understood very clearly. What is the difference between the impersonal conception and the personal conception of God? This must be clearly understood. Nowadays, the impersonal conception is becoming very popular. They call it New Age philosophy. That I'm God, you're God, and we are all God. You just have to realize it. This first became popular back in the 60s. I remember there was one book, it was called The Book. And in this book the author said, actually, you are God. Right now you're simply playing hide and go seek with yourself. Now you simply have to come out of hiding and be God again, you see. The subtitle was, On the Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are. So, I tried it for a while. It seemed okay for a few days. But then it became obvious I wasn't God. So, it doesn't really work, you know. How can all of us be God? I mean, is it logical? How many Supreme Courts are there in Germany? There's one. If there's more than one Supreme Court, it's not the Supreme Court, you see. Supreme means one without a second. There's no other, there's just one entity at that level. When you get to the supreme level, there can only be one. To say that you're God and I'm God both, does that make sense? How can you and I both be God, you see? Doesn't that make sense? It's not a very sound philosophy, really. It's described as the last snare of Maya, you see. The person... He had so many nice realizations. I'm not the body. I have nothing to do with this material nature. It's not really me. After renouncing all these material conceptions, I'm not a German, I'm not a male, I'm not a female, I'm not old, I'm not young, I'm not rich, I'm not poor, I'm not this. He renounced so many conceptions. But one conception he could not give up, that I am God. He held on to that conception. And that was the last snare. There was so many, it's like a minefield. He evaded every single mine throughout the whole minefield. Just when he got to the very end of the minefield, there was one mine left and that nabbed him. I am God. He evaded every other mine. I'm German, I'm American, I'm male, I'm female, I'm young, I'm American, I'm black, I'm Jewish, I'm Christian, I'm this, I'm that. Every single mine of illusion he evaded, but that last mine nabbed him. I'm God. You see, before he got out of the material world, the last mind of it got him, I'm God. So it really doesn't make much sense. You say, how can you be God and be an illusion like that? How can you be suffering here in Germany, worrying about how you're going to maintain yourself? If you're God... See, God has unlimited wealth and power at his disposal. He can do anything and everything. He's not in any anxiety about paying his rent, you see, or getting old and getting sick and dying. It doesn't make sense. Michelangelo, he painted God as an old man with a beard in the Sistine Chapel, you see. Does that make sense, that God's an old man with a beard? Why would God want to get old? I mean, if time is under his control, why would he want to become an old, hard-of-hearing person, you see? What was that? Need a cane, you know, some glasses to get around, you know. Does it make sense? Or a wheelchair. Does it make sense
Is it a logical philosophy? It's absolutely ridiculous. But that's accepted here in the Western world, that God's an old man. They have no conception. Krishna describes very clearly, Nava, or Brahmaji describes very clearly, Navi Yovanam, he's an ever-fresh youth. He never ages, you see. So there's the proof that we're not God, you see. The fact that we're aging, that's the proof. There's a proof right there, you're getting old. Of course, you may say, I'm only, for the young person, they may be in the illusion that, yes, I'll never get old. My body will never age. I'll always be a youth. But time takes its toll. Old age sets in and all the bodily functions start to go downhill. Like an old car, you know. Things start, they don't work right anymore. The indicators don't work. The lights burn out in the panel. You know, the brakes go out. The engine doesn't work properly. I mean, you say, forget it. I'm just going to trade it in for a new model, you know. This is ridiculous. So the body does that. It just gradually wears out. All the different things. The eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the belly, the genitals, the spleen, everything. The pancreas. Everything wears out. So is that God? No. It's not God. God is the source of all the energy. Everything depends on Him. So He never becomes worn down by time. So we should clearly understand the difference as described in this verse. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. I'll never forget the day when this verse really hit me like a string of pearls. I was driving, doing some service for the temple, driving through downtown Dallas on the freeway. And I looked at all the big, you know, all the skyscrapers, and I was thinking, actually, Krishna is the string running through this whole city, holding it together. Every different skyscraper is another pearl on the string, you see, and Krishna is holding the whole thing together. You take this material world minus Krishna, the whole thing just disintegrates into dust, if even that much is left, you see. The whole thing disintegrates. Germany finished. America finished. Everything. The sun, the planet Earth, everything just pulverizes into nothingness. Nothing's there. Krishna is the sustaining power, the maintaining power behind everything. If there's no Krishna, then nothing works, you see. Everything's finished. So Krishna clearly describes here that He is the Supreme Truth. There is no truth superior to Me. So if you are a seeker of the truth, I'm asking you, are you a seeker of the truth? Are you seeking the truth? Yes? Yes, very good. So, if you seek the truth, and you go gradually, and higher and higher levels of truth, you finally come to the point of Krishna. Because Krishna said, there's no truth superior to Me. So we encourage you in your search for truth. You see, everyone should continue seeking higher and higher levels of understanding what is true. That endeavor to understand what is true will lead you to Krishna in due course of time. So everyone is encouraged to seek the truth. What is the absolute truth? Now some people will say there is no absolute truth. The skeptics, they'll say, oh, there is no absolute truth. Don't waste your time. Just, you know, party, enjoy your senses, because there's no absolute truth. They will argue like that. Why waste your time? You're foolish to look for the absolute truth. But we have to ask them this question. My dear sir, are you absolutely sure that there's no absolute truth? They cannot say they are absolutely sure, because that is an absolute. In other words, that philosophy that there is no absolute cancels itself out. It's an illogical, absurd philosophy. There has to be an absolute truth, because its negation cancels itself out. You understand this point philosophically? There must, by out of necessity, there must be an absolute truth. You cannot deny it. If you do, you're contradicting yourself. So now that we can understand simply on the basis of pure logic, that you understand this philosophy? You do not understand. All right. Let me try one more time. Someone who says there's no absolute truth cannot say that anything is absolutely true. Understand? Yes. If I say there's no absolute truth, then I cannot establish anything as being absolutely true. Therefore, I cannot establish there is no absolute truth, quote unquote, is an absolute truth. You understand?
Because it's an absolute statement.
It's an absolute statement. You cannot, therefore there must be an absolute truth. Because its negation is impossible. You understand? Just simply on the basis of pure logic, there must be an absolute truth. So, all right, that's great. Now we know, without any, you know, without any religious faith, without any, you know, sentimentalism or anything, just on the basis of pure logic, we have understood there must be an absolute truth. Okay, now how am I going to find out what it is? That's the next question. How will that absolute truth be revealed to me? And that has puzzled the great thinkers for centuries and centuries, how to realize the absolute truth. The insider's secret known by the followers of the Vedic path is this. Through your own mental speculation, you will never arrive at the absolute truth. Because you are in a conditioned state, you can never, your senses are imperfect. You can never, through your own intellectual power, realize the absolute truth. But when the absolute truth blesses you with realization of the absolute truth, then you can realize the absolute truth. That is the insider's secret, you see. And that is confirmed in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Brahmanda Brahmite Konna Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasade Pai Bhakti Lata Bij. After wandering up and down the Brahmanda, the universe, the upper planets, the lower planets, the middle planets, through the 8,400,000 species as described in the Vishnu Purana, one living entity who is very, very fortunate receives by the combined mercy of the spiritual master and Krishna the seed of bhakti within the heart, you see. That bhakti seed is what is the key that turns on one's realization of the absolute truth. You can't, just like these concerts, you know, people like sometimes they try to gate crash their way in. They're called gate crashers. You know, they try to get in without paying to these rock concerts. Gate crashers, they call them. You cannot gate crash your way into the dimension of absolute truth. You can't gate crash your way in. The absolute truth is too powerful. You can never do it. But if you have a ticket, then you can get in. So what is the ticket for entering into that dimension of absolute truth? That ticket is provided by the Absolute Truth, and that ticket is bhakti. My love, you see. Isn't it said that love can conquer all? That love moves mountains? Yeah. So actually, by love, you can conquer the Absolute and become fully realized in the Absolute. So, that absolute is described in the Vedas as janma jasya jataha. The absolute truth is that from which everything is emanating. You see. So, that makes sense. Everything that we see is a manifestation of the absolute truth. The sky, the trees, the mountains, the people, the buildings, the planets, the outer space, everything we see is a manifestation of the absolute truth. The absolute truth is expanded into everything that we see. Nothing exists, save and except, actually,
Nothing exists save and except the Absolute Truth. That can be understood. And at the same time, nothing is the Absolute Truth except for that original Supreme Source from which all the energies are emanating. Both things are true. So, understanding that the Absolute Truth is the source from which everything is emanating, now we can understand something about the nature of that Absolute Truth. In the manifested reality that's around us here in Germany, we can see there are so many people. I'm a person, you're a person, so many people, you see. So these people, they're all emanations from the Absolute. So what does that tell us about the Absolute? Just imagine if every day I brought you a present. I brought you 1 kilogram of pure gold every day. You become very wealthy very quickly. 1 kilogram of pure gold every day I gave you. So one day you finally say, Sankarshan Prabhu, where are you getting all of this gold? Maybe I can go there and get more than 1 kilo. You know. Where are you getting all this gold, Sankarshan Prabhu? Well, I answer, I've got a gold mine on the other side of the mountain. Oh, really? How much gold is in that mine? Oh, there's no gold in the mine. Come on, you're kidding. You're lying. You're hiding. There must be a huge quantity of gold in that mine if you're getting 1 kilo every day out of it and bringing it to me as a gift. Is it? So this is a little example. If from that Absolute Truth, which is the source of all energies, so many people are coming, that Absolute must be a person. Do you understand? Personality must exist in the Absolute, or the Absolute could not emanate so many persons. You understand? You understand the logic? If so many persons are emanating from the Absolute must possess personality. And if the Absolute possesses personality, should we refer to the Absolute as it? Or should we refer to the Absolute as a person? What is more proper? Just like you have a personality, isn't it? If I were to say every day, how is it doing today? Would you like that? You may tolerate it for 1 or 2 days to be humble. But after a while, you say, what are you, Sankarshan, why do you keep calling me it? Don't you know I'm a person? You see? How is it doing today? Oh, it has such a nice jacket on. Would you like that? I complimented you as it. Oh, it has such a nice, beautiful jacket on tonight. You see, you wouldn't like that. Not for very long anyway. You see, we get pretty old pretty fast. Why are you calling me it? Don't you know I'm a person? You see? So, therefore, since the Supreme Absolute Truth possesses personality, I think it's more proper to call that Absolute as a person, he or she. So that's another debate going on around it. Is God he or is she? You see? They're debating. Some people say he's a he. Some people say, no, she's a she. And they're fighting it out, you see. Some people want to rewrite the Bible, you know. Put she in there instead of he. Because women are much more, you know, they're kind, much more kind-hearted than these men. You're so cruel. So God must be a woman. I mean, come on. They're arguing, you see. But actually, in Krishna consciousness, we have no problem. For us, God is both. She, he. Radha Krishna, you see. In fact, we worship the feminine aspect is more soft-hearted. So we approach the feminine aspect of God, Radharani, Hare first, and then Krishna, the masculine aspect, who is more hard-hearted. The feminine side is more easily approachable. So we worship God as she, he, Radha Krishna, Sita Ram, Lakshmi Narayan. We have no problem. We laugh when they debate because we understand that God is both. He's she and he's God is she, he. We have no, we're not, these debates are ridiculous for us. Our philosophy is far beyond all these different debates going on. So in this way, just by logic, we can understand so many things that there must be an absolute truth and that absolute truth must possess personality. And if that absolute truth possesses personality, then it's common sense to understand that we should relate with that absolute truth as a person. And persons like to be loved, as we talked about even the plant, you see. Persons want to be loved. That's a nature. Don't you want to be loved? You see, isn't that our nature? We all want to be loved. So that is the nature of a person. A person wants to be loved. So that nature is in God. So if we will love God, then our love becomes fulfilled. You see, God is the source of everything. He is the source of all love also. Therefore, all love must be offered back to Him. And then we become fully happy and satisfied. So these are some of the points that can be understood. Actually, there's unlimited points. 1 hour of lecture is nothing. We can, this philosophy, we can speak on for millions of hours, you see. The trouble is we'll all get tired. I'll fall asleep and you'll fall asleep. But the reality is, this philosophy is so sublime and so deep, then it can be expounded from millions and billions of angles of vision and never get old and hackneyed or dry. It suddenly becomes sweeter and sweeter and sweeter and sweeter and richer and more full of meaning, more deep. The more that it is discussed, it becomes sweeter and sweeter. So you all have heard very nicely. Now I'd like to give you a chance to speak up if you have some question. Feel free to speak up with your question.
So the one aspect of absolute to be ever expanded.
I'm hard of hearing, got an old man's body.
Sorry. It's one aspect of the absolute to get expanded every minute.
Yes.
So it's by example that one should say there must be a thing that Krishna doesn't be able to lift up. But somebody said, but in the next minute he can.
Yes, of course.
Expanding.
Yes.
And that's the nature because of the.
Actually, he's not being. If he's not able to lift something, that is simply his.
Left.
His own.
Not lifting.
Lila. No, he's saying lift, yes. Krishna may sometimes make something that he cannot lift for the sake of conquering over that obstacle. Just like when all the cowherd boys went marching and parading into the mouth of a Gasur, you see, that big snake. Krishna, even though he can easily conquer that demon, he became bewildered. What am I going to do? Krishna actually got bewildered. Can you imagine Krishna became bewildered? Prabhupada says he became momentarily aggrieved. that all of a sudden Agasura for him was a stone he couldn't lift, you see. Here was an obstacle he didn't know how to conquer. It. He didn't, how can I do? I can't handle this. For a minute he got aggrieved. But that was his own lila, pleasure pastime. So that he can create out of his own energy an unliftable stone and then turn around and defeat that unliftable stone by lifting it. You see? That is his lila, that is pastime.
So what I want to say is about the Shastra, the Shastra is also an incarnation of Krishna. And this is also ever expanding. Like
yes.
It is so deep, you can't figure out how deep it is.
Just like Prabhupada's books are there, and now how many books are being written by his disciples? And you see, it's just expanding out. More and more. And now you can't even keep up with all the books that his disciples are writing, you see. I mean, it's huge. The Prabhupada's, it's ever expanding. It's an ocean. This Vedic wisdom just keeps expanding and expanding and expanding and expanding. That's right.
You were so nicely explaining that because there are so many personalities, persons around, so this aspect must also be there in the Supreme Law. No, but in the supernatural truth. But one could argue that there is also so much energy and light. So why not just...
So much energy of what?
Energy and light, for example.
There is so much light.
Yes. Yes, there's light also, yeah.
Yeah. So, why are you putting so much, importance to this personal aspect? Because there's also, you can say, there's so much energy, absolute truth.
Okay, I have the answer for you. Here in Heidelberg, you have so much light, the electricity, you see. So you say, why do we need persons? The light is all we need. What does it need for a person? But you trace out the light, you take the wire, and then you follow it all the way back to the powerhouse. And you'll see there's an engineer there who is turning on the whole thing. If that engineer wasn't a person behind the light, there would be no light. That's why it's important. The person is important. You may think the light is very nice, but you're like a small child, you see. If you cannot see the person behind the light, you're like a little child. You cannot understand there's a person behind the light. Yeah. Don't be like a little child. You see, you grow up now. You understand there's a person behind the light. Otherwise, there will be no light. Just like one time, in the grocery store, my godbrother told me, the little child was, they have a little conveyor belt in the grocery checkout, The checker has a little foot pedal, they push it and it moves, you know what I'm saying? And I haven't seen in Germany, but I'm sure you have better gadgets. You are all expert in manufacturing here. Actually, I even saw in the airport yesterday, you had an electric eye on the baggage thing, so it would stop every time there was, it was amazing. You Germans really have it technologically. So I'm sure you have better conveyor belt system than we do in America. But the little child was there, and he would tap on the conveyor belt, and the clerk would make it stop. And the child would tap again, and then he would start it again. So the child thought he was controlling the conveyor belt. The clerk was having a little fun, making the child think the child was controlling the conveyor belt, you see. So you may think that somehow or other you're controlling the light because you have a switch. You may think you're the source of the light because you can flip the switch on and off. But you don't realize you're actually totally dependent on the engineer and the powerhouse. That light being available or not being available has nothing to do with you. You see? Understand?
Watering the tree, automatically, every like twig and leaf and everything, the whole tree gets nourished. And this reminded me because you were speaking so nicely, I had some like realization. I was thinking that because by following the process of Krishna consciousness, I became a more sensitive person, more lovingly, like this, And then naturally, I'm like this, whenever I meet somebody, like parents I even don't know, my parents, and things like this. And it really made me think, because I remember when I went to my parents, I acted completely like lovingly, to them.
Like what?
Like lovingly.
Lovingly. I acted lovingly,
yes.
Towards them. Very, very, I don't know, like mildly and understanding and things like this. And without making an extra endeavor. But actually before, before coming to Krishna consciousness, I was not like this. So I kind of had some realization when you were speaking, that yes, simply just like this, you know, by watering the tree, everything gets like nourished, you know, without making
it extra endeavor. That's right. Yeah, if you become the perfect daughter, the perfect son, the perfect father, the perfect mother, the perfect friend, the perfect teacher, the perfect leader, the perfect everything, when you become Krishna, perfect husband, the perfect wife, everything perfect, when you become Krishna conscious. That's it. So why make so much endeavor? You see, like the silversmith, he's all day, hours and hours and hours, for weeks and weeks, tapping, tapping on the silver to make it just right. Tap, 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 tap. But the blacksmith, he comes along, boom, one stroke, finished, you see. So the gyanis, they are like the silversmith, tapping, tapping, tapping. The absolute truth is not this, it's not that. 19, 18, 18, 18, 18, 18, 18, tapping, 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 18, 18, 18, 18, 18. And the Vaishnava comes along, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Boom, finished, you see. So easy thing. Why endeavor like anything to realize God when God will personally reveal Himself to you within a second? You see, why go the long way when you can come this? Why go up the stairway to the top of the tall building? Why not take the elevator? You see, Bhakti Yoga's elevator. Immediately take to love of God. You see. Then God will personally reveal Premanjana Charita Bhakti Vilochanena. That is Krishna consciousness. Any other question?
I was just thinking about if I was in my adolescent phase years ago.
My what?
Adolescent
days. Okay.
I was meditating about also absolute. And I was thinking, what happens if everyone's gone? What's the end of all? Is that absolute? And I find out this my personal frontier is my how to say? If everyone say it's everything's relative, this is all happened to your consciousness. But you can't. I can't see what's behind these walls, and everyone is so imprisoned in itself that it can't see what's happening.
Yes,
because I also can't see what's behind the floor.
Yeah, those are good realizations, so, you had. Yeah.
I got so feel so imprisoned. I said, yeah, and then I know if I close my eyes, what's happening? If I close my eyes, I can't see and can't. But I can, maybe I can't hear. And then I noticed, what's happening if every living being is gone on Earth? And then something is resting, and that's planet Earth, existence, material existence, exists also without me. And that's what my realization of absolute in the first stage was.
That was nice. You were thinking in terms of trying to understand in terms of universal reality. That's very nice. It's nice that we can try to understand the absolute truth. All you have to do is become very sincere to realize the absolute truth, and Krishna will then send you a spiritual master. That's the purport of that verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Krishna will send to you that person who will then guide you and enlighten you. You have simply become sincere in your desire to realize the absolute truth, and then Krishna will bring you into contact with a bona fide spiritual master who will then totally enlighten you and deliver you from all forms of illusion and anxiety. That's it. Yes?
This is a point. About I was meditating so much time now, years, and I know Krishna consciousness since like 7 or 8 years, and one is coming to this point where one want to have a spiritual master. So, but I was every time I was very afraid to get initiated and to give the promise to keep the four principles, and maybe after some time to get somehow in illusion and to cannot keep this promises mm-hmm. I gave to spiritual master.
That's a sign of your sincerity. Yeah. You don't want to break your vow. That's very good fear on your part.
Yeah. How to deal with this?
Yes. Well, it means you're an honest person. You don't want to commit yourself if you're not convinced that you can keep your commitment. That's a very wonderful feeling. You want to be an honest person with integrity. That's very good. So, but it puts you in a difficult situation also. If you think, well, how can I possibly make a commitment when I know what a dog I really am? You see, how I'm a servant of my senses. How can I possibly make that commitment? So at that point, you just have to beg for mercy. You just have to beg for the mercy. My dear Lord Krishna, I know that I need to take shelter of your teachings, and you're instructing me, tadvidi pranipatena pariprasnena sevya, that I should take a spiritual master. I know that you're ordering me to do this, but my dear Lord, I'm afraid to make this commitment because I'm afraid I will not be able to keep it. So my Lord, I appear to be in a catch-22 situation. I'm asking you to rescue me from this catch-22. I need a guru, but yet I'm not qualified. I don't feel really qualified to surrender to one. So please bless me that somehow I can do that. By your kindness, by your mercy, please bless me. I can find a bona fide spiritual master where I can make a commitment. And I'm willing to just, you know, put myself totally under his direction, under his power and his control, that by his mercy I'll be able to follow these principles. You see, because actually on your own you cannot chant 16 rounds a day and follow the pro-legged principles. It's only, that is that shloka? Mukam karoti vachalam pangum lam gedhe gedim yat kripatamahang vande shi guru dinataranam. By the mercy of the spiritual master. A dumb man, that means someone who can't speak. A dumb man can deliver eloquent speeches. A lame man can cross over the mountain. So, to feel yourself incompetent and unqualified, that is a very good qualification. You simply have to find a spiritual master who will give you his blessings, that you will be able, who will empower you to follow these principles. That's all. You have to find a powerful guru who can empower you to strictly chant 16 rounds a day and follow the regulated principles, you see, and then surrender to him. That's all. And by his mercy, you'll be able to do it. On your own strength, you'll never be able to do it. That's a very good realization. You simply find out that guru who has the power, the shakti, to empower you to do them and take shelter of him. That's all. And by his mercy, you'll be able to. And that's the answer. So you must seek out that guru, that powerful guru, who can empower you to strictly follow these vows throughout your whole life. You understand? Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah. That's all you have to do. You've got to find a powerful guru, that's all. Who can empower you. Find that guru that by hearing him, you feel the power of bhakti come entering into you. That guru you need to find. You see? That just by hearing from him, you feel the power of bhakti. You feel yourself becoming energized in bhakti. That's the guru you need, the one who can do that for you. You see? Any other questions? Yes?
Because you were speaking this morning and also in the evening now, again, about like loving Krishna, you know?
Loving?
Yeah, loving, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But what exactly does it mean, this love? You know, how this is shown? Is it just feeling?
What does it mean to love Krishna?
Yeah, yeah. How
love means obedience. It's a very simple answer. Love means obedience. If I love you, whatever you ask me to do, I will do that. I will happily do that, you see. If I love you, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll do anything you want me to do. I'll do it because I love you, you see. That is love. Not that, oh, just like, It's like the husband, he tells his wife, "Oh, my darling, I love you very much." And she says, "My dear husband, tonight I'm very sick. Can you kindly wash the dishes so I can go to take rest early?" He says, "What do you mean, you lazy bum? I'm going bowling tonight. Get in the kitchen and wash those dishes."
I have no time.
Is it? If you actually love, if I actually love you, I'll do whatever you ask of me. You see, that is love. So if we actually love Krishna, then whatever Krishna wants, we will do. We'll happily do. If Krishna says you should chant, then we will chant. If he says you should dance, we will dance. If he says you take prasad, we will take. If he says to fast, you will fast. You'll be equally happy. If Krishna says, "Now it's time for a feast," you say, "Oh, very good." He says, "Now it's time for fasting." "Oh, very good." You see. Whatever Krishna wants, that's all right. You know that story? Whatever Krishna does is all right. There was one king in the old Indian times, you know, Vedic times. And he had a prime minister. And this prime minister was very Krishna conscious. He was a devotee. The prime minister, whenever the king would say anything, the prime minister would give this advice: whatever Krishna does is all right. You see? He always gave the same advice. But one day the king, he cut off his little finger. He had an accident. He lost his little finger. The prime minister said, your majesty, don't worry about it. Whatever Krishna does is all right, you see. The king became so angry. "I lost my finger and you're saying it's all right? You rascal, in the dungeon with you." He threw the prime minister in the deepest, darkest, dirtiest corner of the dungeon where all the rats were living. Horrible. He threw him in the dungeon, that rascal. So anyway, you know, in the Vedic times, the kings, they would go hunting. Because then there was an attack by the enemy. The king, he would lead the charge. He wasn't like these cowards nowadays who sit in the White House, you know, and send all the young college boys out to get killed in the battlefield, you see. Or the young boys, college, non-college. In the 60s, the whole thing, they were taking everybody out of college and sending them to Vietnam. And they used to say, "Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box." But anyway, it was pretty rough days. But anyway, it wasn't like those days, you see. In those days, the king, he would go onto the battlefield. So he had to be very courageous in battle. That he could take on an enemy and kill him very quickly. He was expert in the killing art. So the king, when there was no war going on, he had to keep in shape for killing. So he would go to the forest and he would kill the wild animals that were harassing the sages, you see. And that way he'd keep his killing art sharpened. It's like the batter, he's always practicing the batting, you see. So when he goes to the ball game, he can hit home run. So the king, he has to keep his killing art very in good shape. So he would go kill the ferocious animals with his bare hands, you see, not sitting behind a rock with a rifle, that he would face them head on with the knife or the sword and kill them directly. In hand-to-hand, in face-to-face combat, he would kill the wild animals. So anyway, he went on a hunting expedition, and there happened to be some dacoits, some criminals who were living in the forest. They were devotees of goddess Kali, and they would capture human beings and they would offer human sacrifice to goddess Kali to get power for their thieving business, you see. So they captured the king and they're preparing him for sacrifice. They gave him gave him a bath, they gave him a new set of clothes, they fed him his last dinner. They're getting ready to slaughter him, you know, for ritual slaughter in front of goddess Kali. But then they notice, "Oh my goodness, how do we overlook this? He's missing a finger. If we offer him to goddess Kali, an imperfect human, she'll be so angry. We cannot let him go." He said, "You go home. You're not suitable for offering. You're missing a finger." So he's thinking, "Oh my goodness. The prime minister said, whatever Krishna does is all right. I lost a finger, but it saved my life. Yes, whatever Krishna does is all right. But what have I done to my prime minister? Oh my goodness." So he went rushing back. He got on a horse. He went rushing back to the palace and went straight down to the deepest, darkest, dirtiest corner of the dungeon where all the rats were living, and opened the door And there was his prime minister, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare. The king said, "My dear prime minister, you're not angry at me. You were right. Whatever Krishna does is all right. I've thrown you in the dungeon. Why are you not angry at me?" He said, "Your Majesty, whenever you go on those hunting trips, I always go with you. And I have all my fingers. Whatever Krishna does is all right." You understand? Did you get the point? Because the prime minister, had all of his fingers, he would have been slaughtered to Goddess Kali. So he took it as Krishna's mercy that he was put in the prison. You understand? This is Krishna's arrangement. I was saved. By being put in the dungeon, I was spared my life. You see, whatever Krishna does is everything. So in this way, you have to, if you want to love Krishna, if you really love Krishna, then you will see that every single situation that Krishna puts you into at every second, in your 24/7, is all his special mercy upon you. You will never think, "Krishna, why are you doing this to me?" You see? This is confirmed in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Tattenu kampam susamikshamano bunjanna evatma kritang vipakam tadvagvapurvirvidadang namaste jiveta yo mukti pade sadaya bhak. You know that shloka? Nectar devotion. Very nice verse. My dear Lord, those devotees, those persons who are always offering respectful, those persons who are always awaiting your causeless mercy to be bestowed upon them, who are suffering the reactions to their past misdeeds, simultaneously offering you respectful obeisances from within the innermost core of their hearts, are certainly eligible candidates for liberation. Indeed, it has become their rightful claim. So that's love. That whatever Krishna gives you as a result of your past misdeeds, you're saying, "Thank you, Krishna. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for this. Thank you, Krishna." You never think, "Oh, this isn't fair. I didn't deserve this. Why is Krishna doing this to me?" That is not love. That's hate. If you actually love Krishna, whatever comes, you say, "Oh, Krishna, you're so kind to me. You put me in this horrible situation just to purify me. This is your love for me. Now I have to somehow pay you back, Lord, for being so kind to me by putting me in this difficulty to purify me from the reactions to my past misdeeds." In this way, now do you understand what is love? To always appreciate what Krishna is doing and always being fully thankful, respectful, and obedient to him at every second with your every thought, your every word, and your every deed in all times, all places, and all circumstances. You understand?
But if I don't see it, like this shloka you were quoting, if I don't see it like this, you know, that I'm happy about the suffering which Krishna sends to me for my purification,
that means you don't trust him. You don't have full faith in Krishna. Lust?
Mm-hmm.
Yes? The influence of lust?
Yes.
Yes, of course. You're lusty. You want to be the enjoyer. And Krishna's not giving it to you. So you're finding fault with Krishna. Yes, it means you're lusty. So stop being lusty. You see? Half of our audience left. We went on so long, they left. So I think we'll stop here. Raja Vidra, Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.